Perfect. All right, so we are back with our last episode on our freelance course, and we are so excited because not only do we have a fellow senior designer, a fellow podcaster himself, but someone who is launching right into freelance big time right now at the same time. So everybody, welcome Ryan Wheaton. Ryan, welcome to the course show, whatever we want to call it. How you doing?
What's up?
Yeah,
thanks for having me on, man. I'm really excited to jump on and talk about all the stuff you guys got going on with your freelance course. This is pretty rad. So
cool, man. And this is so good because the three of us kind of all know each other and like and kind of follow each other's work. And both Ryan and Jordan are from Portland.
That's right.
So yeah, man, this is going to be a fun little show. Can't wait to dive into it. So you got some questions for us like we usually do with the end of our course. And we're excited to hear. We have not heard any of these. So Jordan and I are a little scared, but also too,
I think
this gives us the best, I think a much truer, candid answer, yeah. Don't you think?
Well, and I also think we should talk about like, you know, I think Ryan's a good candidate for this sort of Q&A, whereas the last one we had a new designer, but Ryan, you're coming from like sort of the world of agency into freelance. And so you're kind of touching on both worlds. So I think you'll have a really good perspective. We can all kind of talk about, you know, our own sort of journey into this as well.
Exactly. Why don't you, if you want, just give a brief kind of bio on what you're doing now, your podcast and your blog, whatever you want to kind of get, tell the listeners a little bit more about yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, cool. Thanks for having me on. Like, I'm super stoked. And I think, as you mentioned, Jordan, I think this is like a pretty unique, you know, I'm in a unique situation, I gotta think, to a certain point in that I've been a professional designer for 15 years, but I'm just now starting to get more into the world of freelance as like my full-time thing. Yeah. So my background is like, I started designing for a manufacturing company as like an in-house designer. And then from there, I went on to do vehicle wraps and like large format printing, which was a pretty cool background to have.
Totally.
For these days. Yeah, it's useful to have that knowledge. And then I spent 10 years at a marketing agency where I was a creative director for like the last like 6 years. And so during that time, I kind of got to a point where, well, I was also a like lead designer and co-founder for a number of startups through that same agency.
Yeah.
And so that was cool because it got me a lot of different experience. But I kind of, in the whole kind of like tech world, doing like UX and like application design, I kind of figured that I was just like really not going down the path of like what I wanted to do.
Sure. Yeah.
I've been an avid craft beer fan for forever. And
good man. Yeah.
Yeah. So then I got to the point where I was just like, man, like I need to kind of get back to my roots of doing just more like traditional branding and like print design. And so then I started doing a lot more freelance work, and decided to kind of like hone in on a niche, which is craft beer.
Sure.
So
I mean, Portland's the right place for that too. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Jordan.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So from that point, like, I just started working with, I got some brewery clients, just kept at it and was doing like freelance on the side, and just kept going at it. And, just started developing my portfolio and kind of, my expertise in the niche of craft beer. And then, a little over a year ago, created a podcast called Branding Brews. And so it's a podcast like covering all aspects of branding, a brewery or beer. And, Nick Longo's been on the show a little bit. So that's been awesome. So I think,
cool, man.
I think my background, I think is gonna be pretty good for this. So yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. I'm excited for this.
All right. What's, where do you want to start?
Well, cool, man. So I listened to your last course. I thought it was really valuable, really awesome. So I kind of took a little bit of the format from your last Q&A a little bit.
Awesome.
Nice.
Which I think is valuable to, you know, be able to kind of call out the different episodes and kind of points that you covered.
It gives like an opportunity to like, if we don't touch on something or we miss something or have another perspective, I think, you know, it helps wrap up this whole idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. cool. So I'll jump in with episode ones, which was, I believe, is pros versus cons.
Yeah.
And so the first point I wanted to bring up and ask you guys about was the aspect of control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, so what I was kind of curious to ask you guys both was, like, what areas when it comes to having control over all aspects of running your design business or freelance work, like, what areas of having that full control kind of, like, caught you by surprise? And I guess maybe some possible examples there would be, like, scheduling your work time or, like, project and client management or, like, sales and marketing. Like, when you went to do running your own business, like, what caught you by surprise the most and, like, maybe you weren't the most prepared for?
Yeah, man. Wow. This is good. I wish we had these in advance.
I offered.
No, it's fun on the cup. No, maybe I not love for the listeners, better. But certainly for us. I mean, I'll take that. Look, I think I was certainly most surprised by how less the design work there was. Meaning, like, I was doing all the small things, all the onboarding, all the landing the clients, the reaching out. I mean, working with printers. Like, I was doing everything. And initially, I didn't realize that it was just essentially more running a business and less of design, right? And I think that was at least the most surprising thing, and certainly the biggest thing, the biggest learning curve for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I would say, gosh, the biggest surprise in the fact, control, I think it's naive to think that you're going to be able to control your clients more in a freelance gig than, let's say, in whatever. And I remember being asked that question once, and they were like, I'm a little, I really want to get into freelance because I want control back. And it's like, well, the only thing you're really controlling is your company, the growth of your company, the performance and the reputation of your company. And maybe, like the three of us have done, is kind of finding niche work and specialty work that we really like. And that's not so much to say specialty style, but a specialty industry or specialty segment or, you know, your clients are you strive to get someone of a certain size of a client, or, you know, that could be a specialty right there. So it's not so much that it's like the control is really everything your company is, not so much controlling the client into steering them the right way and all that other kind of thing. That's still, you know, we're still in client services. So I think I like to stay open and I like to stay open saying that. So like, I think that might be the biggest surprise is that, wow, yeah, your wheel that you get to steer is all about your business, not so much about the work you're going to do. And, but then you can choose that, but I don't think that's smart to think that you can do that right at the beginning. I think it's smart to take everything you can get, build up some revenue and see what you really like.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's what I would say.
Yeah.
What about you? I mean, Ryan, you're going through this right now. I'm curious, you know, your perspective here, especially just sort of entering this.
Right. So I think, I think I was caught by surprise and by a number of ways. It was really interesting because I had a unique position at the agency I was at I was kind of the owner's right-hand man. And it was great because it was kind of a bummer because I ended up being like the project manager as well designer and creative director. but that was good for me because then like, I've taken projects from beginning to end, like literally from like quoting how much time I was going to take to getting all of the assets from the client and making sure everything's running smoothly. I mean, I even hired and managed contractors. So when I went over to do my own thing full time, I was just like, dude, this is cake. I got this. I've been doing this for years. But I think that one of the downfalls was that the agency I was with wasn't very... I don't know how to put this, but maybe like organized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we didn't do time. We didn't do time tracking, you know, just loosely. And so, you know, when you're working for a company too, like you're not so much like thinking about how many billable hours you're working. You know, you're just like, I'm there from 9 to 5.
Yeah.
So I think the biggest, challenges I've seen coming out into this is really was just, scheduling my work time, you know, like, what is like the realistic expectation of how many billable hours you can do in a day for client work?
Sure.
You know, and then, and I think, you know, then some of it on the sales and marketing side too, you know, obviously that's something I hadn't really had to do before, but, yeah, I mean, sales is a whole game in itself.
It really is.
Yeah. And I've been a little surprised too about how many clients, like proposals that I get out there that, you know, they're shopping around. So yep. you're competing with, you know, three or four other agencies, maybe mm-hmm. even, and you're solo, you know, you're a solo, you know, designer. So that's been a like curve too, is just realizing that you're going to have to get a lot of proposals out there to start winning some of them.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
And look as good as the next guy, regardless of who they are. So, it's pretty interesting that you're competing for something with people that you maybe you never had before. So that could be, I look at that even when it's when I'm scared or a little like, am I the right? You know, am I ready for this? I still think of it as the best challenge in the world. So it's like, again, most of the time when we were talking about those pros and cons, man, all of them can, the positives can be negatives and negatives can be positive, you know, in this world of freelance.
Yeah, truly.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. Well, cool. And that's actually a good segue to the second one.
We're so segue masters, man.
Oh, yeah.
Go for it.
Yeah. Right. So again, this is the same episode one. And you were, you know, one of the, I think, pros, you know, was that your rates as a freelancer are determined by you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that's obviously a huge thing that I think somebody, especially first starting out, you know, you have to figure out your rates and, you know, all that stuff like that. But, so this is like kind of a, taking a little bit of a spin on that. But it's like, I mean, sometimes potential clients can see you being a freelancer as like a negative.
Yes.
Sure. You know, for instance, like, you know, agencies have entire teams to work on client projects. And I think you guys kind of talked about that a little bit. And so there's a number of scenarios that you might have to like deal with when this kind of thing happens. So it's a two-part question, so I'll just start with number one. How do you pitch to clients that are, when they're choosing you, that like a freelance or like a one-man shop business can be beneficial to them? Like how do you sell yourself as being a good option as opposed to hiring an agency?
So the question on this one is when you're preferring to be positioned as a one-man shop, how do you do it and why, basically, right?
Hmm. Well, right. So, I mean,
is that what you're saying?
Sort of the benefits of that?
Yeah. What's the benefit of that?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you obviously imagine when you get started, you're going to be a one man shop. You know, you might have visions to hire on more employees down the road and become a full on agency, but you're starting solo, and so you're going to get clients. They're going to come to you, and you know, you're going to put together a proposal, and they're going to be like, you know, basically why you know, like the agencies have a particular appeal to them because they have all those team members and dedicated people for different, you know, aspects of each project. So, curious to see how you pitch yourself as a solo business designer that you are a good fit.
I think you find there's signs in the first few meetings with them to know how to best position yourself. And it might be tell them you're a team, tell them you're solo, or anywhere in between, right? Sometimes maybe even be vague on that, so there's not anything to define and you fit a mold that they're thinking of very naturally, because maybe you haven't defined yourself too much, right? But I think some of the benefits that come for just being smaller, either one or two people, one or three people, as opposed to a 10-member team, is how nimble and the attention to detail, the one-on-one that you can give them by being always available. I find when I have been up against other places or I have clients that work with bigger firms, a lot of times they tell me, wow, your response is much faster. When we need something, it's much quicker. When I need something, you're available on the phone. So I pocket those as fantastic little keynotes to put in my presentations with new clients to say, here's what other clients have favored about working with my team. And then it looks like great advantage. So it's almost like, right, you got to almost hear what they're saying to know how to react.
I mean, that is a big pro of being sort of a smaller team. It's you have that flexibility, and you just, no matter what, it's harder with a big group, right? If you have 12 people and everyone's doing a different department for this giant brand, like if you need to change something on the fly or, you know, you need to pivot somewhere, it does take longer.
Mm-hmm.
But I think having that sort of the strength and being able to do that quickly. And I do think, I mean, the personal touch is really nice. It's like one-on-one, you're always going to talk through me, like with me, you know, if you need something, like I can give you my personal cell. I don't often do that, but like I sometimes do, you know what I mean? Like there is a personal touch. But there's ebb and flow. Like, I do market myself, especially with, you know, clients. I want to seem bigger than a freelance. Most often, I've never really had someone, prefer the smaller group necessarily. But I do think that there are advantages to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think I totally agree on all those points. Yeah, I mean, you usually can be much more responsive and you can be much more like, you know, there. I agree on all those points for sure. And then I think, like you mentioned too, I think that in your episode that, you know, you don't have the same overhead. You know, you don't have to have like, you know,
yeah.
You don't necessarily have to have a lease. You don't have to be paying, you know, 5-10 employees and all that stuff like that. So,
but also too, you don't have the layers of process that naturally build at a small agency. And then when it goes from client saying, I need a change, to client getting the change, it has to hit 6 people. And at my last agency, it was just like that. We narrowed it down to like 3 or 4, but that every one of those clicks is like, well, he might be away from his desk and she might be at lunch and all that stuff. Next thing you know, they're getting used to getting changes in 2 days, whereas you might be able to do it in an hour into 2 hours. So again, it's just those little flexibilities that you got to use to your advantage, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Sweet. Okay. So then the second part of this is kind of along the same lines. So, and I've run into this before too, a little bit, but, so there's going to be potential clients that will see you as like a freelancer in quotes.
Yes. Yeah.
With the idea of like you being like cheap, or, you know, and like I've had people before, which is like a ridiculously awesome being like trying to like rebuttal your proposals and be like, why does it cost this much? Like you're a designer, right? Like, you know, and, so, you know, or like they're like, oh, why does it cost this much? Like, I only needed to hire you to do like 4 hours of work for this project, which in itself is a red flag, which I think you guys talked about in this series as well. But so, I mean, how do you curious to see from your perspective, how do you avoid potential clients seeing you just as a freelance, in quotes, designer?
Yeah.
You know, they could do work for whatever dollar an hour, to being like a professional business and being a big asset to that client.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest thing in change for me was like, I set a goal to market myself, not just as a designer anymore. Like I want them to come and I'm going to build a brand with them. Right. And that can go in a lot of different directions. I think a website is kind of the key component, especially when you have case studies and you can show them how you're going to take them from maybe just an idea, right? Like I bake bread to here's the full brand, bake bread, like all the onboard. So I think really setting your process and then showcasing that it's more than just, you know, you're hiring me for a logo. I typically don't even like just doing logo projects, period. Like,
yeah.
I want to do a full brand nowadays because I want the control, because most logos, you have to base it off that stuff anyway. So I think, the first and foremost is like I need to show them and make them aware that I'm not just a designer.
It's your perception. It's exactly that. It's how you present yourself. So I saw little by little when I made little tweaks and changes to online or how I even presented myself or how I put a pitch deck together, it was, I learned every time how to remove that word and now put consultant, or remove this word and put professional, or brand builder. Like all these little like changes in the way you present yourself change your perception to them. And that's, again, a positive because it's in your control. You can do this. You don't have to submit this to someone and say, can we change the way our company looks? You do this. It's 100% your responsibility. And also too, it's like, I know it's tough too, because as a young person or someone getting into it at the beginning, it's hard to say that at the very beginning and say, I'm only going to accept brands of this big or this project of that big. You just got to learn how to start exercising that after you get a few things under your belt. And then yes, it means saying no to a few things because you want to be ready for the one that finally does say yes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's little tweaks and bends along the way to make yourself look the way you want to be presented as.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's a tough one.
Yeah.
It's a tough one because it's very, I'm glad you brought that part up because again, like maybe it's fresh out of my mind because it's been a few years since I had that problem. But now when someone does still slip through and asks for that one-off thing, I just have a way of explaining to them why I'm not the right person for them. And I have one or two people that I can shoot them off to.
Yeah, that's a big one too. Yeah, exactly.
You know? So then you still come through as a nice, you know, networking solution with these people.
Yeah, man, I think that's perfect. Yeah, I think that I'm sure a lot of people find this balance challenging, especially when you're first starting. And Nick, I know we've talked about this when we hung out recently, but yeah. It's like, you know, when you're first starting, you have to keep the lights on. So it's like, and I think Jordan, you talked about this too, you know, like when you started, you're getting started. It's like, so it's just that balance of, and I totally agree. Once you get to a certain point, you have to start refining who your clients are, presenting yourself as that branding professional. They can do all of this stuff, not just a logo designer. So yeah, I think it's a matter of getting to that point where, you can start saying no and start trying to like present yourself in that way and focus on clients that are, they're going to be better clients and like see you as this like asset and a partner. So
yeah. And a lot of that comes with, you know, your process and then how you present that process. And I certainly wasn't doing any of that when I started. And I also found that I was constantly feeling like I had to defend my value as a designer, especially as a young designer, you know? And it only comes with confidence, and the confidence again only comes with just kind of doing it and maybe sometimes making those mistakes and figuring out, you know, what seems to be successful and how you're starting to land better clients and really capitalizing on that.
Yeah. Yeah. I had this client, like, it totally caught me by surprise, but like, he just totally called. He was just like, why is it going to cost this much? Like, I only need you for this many hours, but it was a pretty big project. It was like a new, like hard seltzer, beverage brand coming out that needed full packaging and needed the can labels. And I was just like, man, you know, kind of a somewhat typical response is like, yeah, I've been designing for 15 years. Like, that's what you're paying for, you know? Yeah. Like, I know the industry, but he saw it as just like, he saw it as just like, he needed to hire a designer and pay him for like 10 hours or something.
And so I think it's obviously those circumstances where that becomes the problem. 'Cause they're seeing like, you're giving me a package design. It's like, no, I'm not. Mm-hmm. Like, we're going to take this broader. Like, we're going to really define your, you know, your target market. We're going to talk about strategies going to market. We're going to, every reason, like every design has a reason behind it. And it's about defining those reasons. And so if you can kind of present it, it's like, it's not just a sticker on a can. Like, it's so much more than that. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah. I think sometimes the best thing to do in that situation is tell them what they'll get if they continue that route and find a designer who will agree with it. They will get crap. They will get something rushed and they'll feel
baseless design.
And the fact that they paid, you know, $1,500 for it instead of $15,000 for it, they will understand. They're going to go through it the hard way. So it's almost like give them a little glimpse of what it's going to be like if they don't.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. Cool. Sweet. Okay. So I'm gonna jump over to, I think, episode 5. When you're talking about getting clients. And so on the first point, I was on like landing clients. And so I mean, like, getting a client signed on to work with you quickly and easily is like super golden. But I find more and more that that's not always the case. Like, as I talked about, like, you're competing against, you know, you could be competing against 3 or 4 other proposals. They're shopping around, you know. So I think it's important for like first time freelancers starting their businesses to know that you will likely be competing with other agencies or designers, when a client's trying to find the right fit for their project. So again, this is another 2-part question, but I will start with number one. I'm getting in depth here.
I like it.
So what percentage of clients contact you and then sign a contract with you? Like, where you're not competing against other proposals, they like come find you, talk to you, and they're like, yes, sign, let's roll. Like, how often, like, what percentage of that is, do you find
that actually like reach out and don't expect to look elsewhere?
Because I mean, I've gotten clients reach out and like I've had amazing conversations on the phone, a number of conversations. Get them the proposal, expecting them to be like signed because everything was going so well. And then I hear back from them like a week later and they're like, oh, well, we're reviewing like 3 other proposals. We'll get back. Mm-hmm. We'll get back to you. And I was just like, damn, I thought I had you sold like and signed and ready to roll, you know. But then all of a sudden you're like competing against all these others. And it's such a, you have to build a relationship with these people and like get them to like want to hire you on. So,
and it's a lot. That's a lot of time and hours to get them to like you, you know. I would say, nowadays, I'm lucky, dude. I would say a good 80%, if not more, come from the contact. We make a relationship. We make a pitch. We make a solution, and they go with it. But I don't, that took time. I remember back in the first few years, it was much harder because they found you via searching rather than a connection or a referral. And now that they come through most, I'd say close to 80 to 90% come through referral, then there's an instant trust and bond because it came from someone. And God bless good networking, because man, when someone gives you that, you know, that seal of approval, and it, you can even see it in an email when they introduce you, then that person, hopefully too, they're getting people in that are much more likely to pull the trigger faster because they're real. I think what happens sometimes is you find people that are not ready for it, and then it will die, or they'll go with someone else just based on budget. And I didn't, you don't want those in the first place. So again, it's a learning curve. You can't expect that right at the beginning, but if you build up enough of a good reputation and referral system, you'll eliminate that problem.
I couldn't agree with that any more. I mean, I would say starting off, like, that would happen pretty frequently with me. But at this point, most of my work comes from referrals from other clients. And that's what we talked about in that client episode. Like, you know, client retention and giving that 100% experience is so crucial beyond just like having the work with a client. But in most cases, they're going to refer friends and friends of friends. Like, you're going to get work. And if you already have that sort of referral from someone they trust, well, then you're kind of already ahead of the whole pack in terms of just like them competing.
You're already pre-approved.
And I will say, for the ones that are shopping around, and typically like the ones that are referred to me, they'll say that initially in the message, or I'll know that they're going to, you know, reach out. But other than that, like, I just try to make those first impressions like crucially. I mean, that's going to set the tone for the entire process. So I think that first, second email, whatever you can do, take, I know, a couple hours to make like a nice looking template. Don't just send, you know, like whatever you can do to set the tone will help increase those chances.
First impressions, man. First impressions.
Yeah. Just making them happy, look professional, you know.
That's the best advantage we have, man, is we can do that stuff. So think of if you were in any other industry where you have to go to someone to make all these marketing materials. We get to do it ourselves. So like, take 100% advantage of that for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Yeah, no, I completely agree. Yeah, and I think, I guess looking back on it after I wrote this question, it's like, I realized that these are often leads I'm getting from my website.
Yeah.
So, you know, but right, if you have a good, if you're getting solid referrals, then they're much more likely just to sign on right away.
Yeah,
totally.
But your perspective here is actually interesting because, you know, and like we mentioned, you're specializing in the beer realm, and in your website definitely showcases that, right? So it makes sense why you're getting a lot of like breweries or, you know, any other beverage company coming to you, because you're advertising this. And it makes sense, like a lot of them will be new for the first time and they are currently shopping around. So I would be interesting, and to see like the best way to combat that in that situation, you know, where it's like your specialty and you're reaching out and your website really feels like, you know, if you're a brewery, we can help you the here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that, I guess that kind of leads me to the next question, but I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. Like I've been really having to try to build on, you know, this is going into the sales process too, but like really nurturing relationship with them first to see you as an expert. And then, you know, that gives them more reason to like to get to know you and then I want to hire you. So and then so I mean I guess that would come to the next question of the next part of this question, and I think, you know, we can maybe rephrase it a little bit or take it in a little different spin, but so when it comes to competing against others to land a project, do you have any tips for freelancers to like create better relationships with a client like early on, to just like overall look better in the client's eyes or during the client's like selection process? And I know you touched on this quite a bit, like those initial emails, like looking professional, like onboarding, stuff like that. But so yeah, like when they first start contacting you, like to like build a better relationship with those clients early on, to try to like position yourself as the one they'd want to hire.
Yeah. You know, I would say, and we might've touched on this a little bit, so I might be repeating myself, but it really, it's all about cultivating that experience and being available and quick responses. Like I want to set the tone for the entire project. And also like, I have certain templates designed ready for like certain aspects, you know, especially with the beer side. Like I have a lot of my experience comes from the beer side, just like you, Ryan. So like I have examples ready to go. I have like a couple case study, you know, PDFs that I'll send them. It also helps, like, you know, especially if they're kind of in that realm and they're taking it seriously, like I can talk numbers pretty well. I can talk about, you know, going to market strategies, but I think it's really just like, I want to set the tone that I'm going to be available. It's going to be a really good experience. You know, if I'm going to send them something, I'm going to design it, make it look good. So it's not just letters on, you know, whatever. And cultivating that experience as best you can through relationships and also deliverables.
Yeah. You nailed it by saying whatever you have on hand to show or be, to take the presentation or the pitch a different level. And I think a lot of times what I have now is probably about 20 or so very fine-tuned, specific little PDFs that are of specific merit or case study style. And let's say it's someone that comes to me and says, we're a toy company, we need packaging, rebranding, whatever, and we know you've done it, but I have a perfectly made PDF that's talked specifically to that. But then also, too, it's not just the case studies and fancy pictures, but talk about, like what you said, numbers, process, knowing factories that are going to have to print this. Any insight, knowledge that you have, pop it in there, because chances are the other guy might and has to wing it. And that's where you can shine by having specific knowledge of particular, let's call them, you know, insights or areas or industries. Because, man, that just pumps up your trust value. And then they'll see that and go, damn, I didn't even know we had to supply a die line or copy or UPC codes or all these other things. And some other guy might not even know that's going to come down the road.
That's true. Yeah, I think the process is actually probably the crux of it. Like every new client wants to know what to expect. And so if you can like design something where it's like a PDF or something, and this can change with whatever client, you can adapt it.
But exactly.
To take them through the process immediately in a way that is visually like stark and like and pleasing and professional, I think that kind of stuff is going to either set you apart or definitely put you on the top rather than just text, you know, emailing what's going to happen.
And keep in mind, they're going to share this document because they might be the only contact out there searching. So if they're bringing it into a meeting, you want to make sure you build it that it's very elementary and it's easy to understand. So if they're putting it on a TV or distributing it to other team members, make sure it's speaking for itself and it doesn't need any handholding, you know, throughout the process.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've been nerding out on this a lot too, and like I think, like the onboarding process, you know. And I was talking with Jordan, I think, like about creating like a really great like PDF kind of like client introduction kind of like manual or kind of like really well designed that kind of tells them how what it's going to be like to work with you, and just a nice way to get them onboarded. And
That's been on the back burner for a long time for me.
It takes time. It's all that kind of stuff. Yeah. It takes a lot of time. But again, if you're freelance and you're in control, this is where your strengths can be like really lie. And I think a good example, and Ryan, we were talking about this when we were having beers the other day, but like the Forefathers group manual that they have, it's brilliant. It's just like a downloadable ebook that takes the client through the entire process and explains, you know, what everything's going to look like, why they do the things they do, et cetera. And it's great. I mean, like, if you have something like that built that you can just, again, it'll take time to build it, but then you'll have it and you can just send that to every client. It's going to look great. And I think that's going to help definitely attract and retain some solid clientele work.
You know what? No one ever said after reading their little download is, why does this cost so much again?
Exactly.
Because honestly, they answered that question right there by giving a quality handover thing that just, It took the time to spell it out. Why, how much, how we do it, all that other stuff kind of erases all the competition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
Yeah. I came across this interesting idea from a kind of like a consulting business podcast, but it was to take the approach to like, imagine if you were to charge your clients to work with you, kind of like if you think about like you pay to get into like Disneyland. Right.
Yeah.
So it's like, imagine if like you were charging your clients from the second they stepped in your inbox or whatever, what would you have to do to make that, like, to give that client an experience that was worth paying for? You know, so like every single thing that they touch point that they come into, like, and I think it just frames it in a way that makes you really think about how you can make every possible touch point and experience with a client memorable and like a valuable experience. So I think if you look at it that way, I think it makes it really like kind of helps you like frame it.
That is a good perspective to, or at least a good scope to kind of see it all through. Like that first class experience. And you're right. Like as soon as, you know, they send you that first email, it starts. Yeah, I think that's actually really great.
Yeah. Cool. Sweet. So I'm going to, next one here is on the same episode 5, talking about working with the clients. And I think, you know, I think you need to position yourself as an expert and be like in control of the relationship as much as you can. And I think this, I think some of this came from Win Without Pitching, the manifesto. I think, have you guys read that at all?
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't read that, no.
Okay, yeah, Win Without Pitching, it's really good. And I think the idea is that if you start off a client relationship and you kind of lose ground as not being like this like super high elevated expert, your relationship with the client over time is going to naturally decline to where you see yourselves as equals, or you see yourself as like, right, so I think establishing yourself as the highest possible like expertise from the beginning is really important.
Yeah.
You don't want to just be like an order taker. You don't want to be pushing pixels. So I think like what approaches or methods have you found best to kind of establish yourself as that expert and like set expectations for the client that they should value your input and your expertise?
Yeah. I think currently it's going to be tough because this is where I'm at now. At the beginning it was different, but now it's like, I've had enough experience and I've seen enough numbers where like, I know that what I do will make them more money. And that is like maybe a scary thing to sort of relay when you're starting out, because you don't know, but you know, right?
Yeah.
But like, I've seen enough of the numbers and I've had enough of the feedback from clients. Like, I know that I will make them more money. And especially if it's going to be in something where I have a lot of experience, like the beer world, and I actually have clients' numbers that they've, you know, given me. Like, I know that I can take them through that process and I can like show them the hard data, which is everything, right? Like that's why they're coming to you, because they want you to make them more money. And so if you can provide, you know,
proof,
good reasons, proof behind that. But starting out, like it's tough because you don't know. And so that's where it's like, it's really about creating that like first class experience until you do enough where it's like, oh, this is working. Actually, here's examples of this working, you know?
Man, that's a good one. Cause at the beginning, the only tools you have are really, the impression you make and what you leave them with. And like, it's a lot of what we just went over, which is your collaterals and your things that you're handing over, but try to make sure that sometimes what I did too, is I would write a few little pointers down before a phone call to make sure these were things that I made sure I highlighted that were things that they were going to get from working with me. If it just needs a little reminder, so it comes in more naturally in the conversation, I'm not going to start a phone call off like, headline number one, I'm the best. You know, it's not like that. But have a few great benefit lines that you can just interject into the first few phone calls a little bit more. Because I think, when you test those waters that way, you'll hear them go, Oh, I never thought of it that way. Okay. Like, yeah, the brand, it just starts with the logo, but there's other elements. Oh, okay. And then like, if you're just educating them, and then everything else we've said, as far as process and all that other stuff, you drop those in there, that allows you, that makes you sound beyond better. So even if you haven't practiced it enough, at least we all know the right commandments that are going to make a project work well. So try to just make sure you're highlighting them and make sure you're mentioning them to them and how they're going to get it with you, you know?
Yeah.
Because it takes a while to build up to have proof and all that other stuff. And that's tough, man. But when you get that, oh, fuck, then you're golden. You know, that's crazy.
Yeah. And when you get those good clients, like, I will ask for that stuff. And maybe it's not like the hard numbers. Not every client's going to open up that book, but at least like, can you tell me the percentage of you? Exactly. That kind of stuff is really, really helpful.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one idea I saw on that too is kind of the idea that when you start a new client project or new client relationship, is the idea of kind of like zero-based work, where it's like you are going to take whatever they have from like the ground level, from like ground zero. Because yeah. if they come to you and they're like with preconceived notions, they're like they think they can just tell you what to do because they already know what they want. Like then they're not getting they're not getting the value out of you that they should be, right? So if you kind of take them from the beginning, from the very beginning, and tell them like, no, we're gonna start from ground zero. Like we'll take your ideas and we're not gonna discard those, but we're gonna start from the ground level and work up. And that way, I think if you show you're gonna prove out of your value in that sense.
Yeah. Because I think it really is defining. Like we have more value than just designing. And I often will like put in my network. Like I can, if you need something printed, I have a whole bunch of guys I use. Like I can get you deals. I know if you need a website, I got guys. Like there's value in also our connections, and I want to bring the clients within that too, you know, and try to even sell that aspect as well.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Well, sweet. I'll jump over to episode 6, which I believe is the checklist.
Yeah.
And so as I mentioned earlier, like I think one of my biggest challenges has been like time management. And that's like, you know, juggling client work with like administrative or business development type work.
Yeah.
So curious to hear like how each of you like kind of set up your time like these days. Like do you just designate certain parts of the day for email or like certain time slots for marketing? I'm just kind of curious how you set up your time on like regular daily, weekly basis. Or just like whatever, just chaos.
Yeah. No, I try not to let it be chaos. Sometimes it is. Like sometimes I'll take on more work or scope creep will happen. It not always, but I do try to like on Mondays typically are like an admin day for me. And this is where I'm reaching out. And if there, you know, something is due, I try not to make it due on this day. But I mean, what I try to do, and look, this isn't always the case, but like I do try, if I'm having like maybe 3 clients right now at the same time, I'm going to try to dedicate one day to each instead of like one day I'm going to hit all 3, because my mind doesn't, I need to get into the focus. Like, all right, I'm doing a Saturday this day. That means I'm going to absorb myself. I might have a cider. I'm going to get into that element and everything I do will be focused on that client. Maybe Wednesday will be whatever it is, whatever project I have at the time. And so that typically helps me.
Yeah.
And also, you know, Sunday nights or maybe even Mondays, I'm going to plot out my week. That kind of helps too. Like making a list and actually like, okay, here's my schedule for the week. Because it can get crazy. You know, I mean, most designers aren't using, they're not just with one client at a time. Oftentimes they're with 2, 3, maybe more. I am curious about your guys' view because I'm not the best. Like, I say these things, but also, like, I overload sometimes, or a client's like, I need this done actually 2 days ago. And it's like, oh, okay. So you do have to be flexible in that. But I definitely try to stick to a regimen of some sort, but it definitely changes.
Yeah, I'm no master in that in any way. And part of me hasn't changed anything because it's regardless of what's thrown at me, you always find a way to get it done. Could it have been a lot better? Yeah. But it's hard to pause everything and reorganize how you're going to time manage yourself. Like that's the hardest thing for me because it's different all the time. And like 2 weeks ago, I had 4 major projects going on at the same time and I was dying. Like it was just, but your brain knows that. And so you are just nonstop and you're finding every ounce of time to do it. What I found when I was in that busy zone was I found better time periods of the day that were more efficient for me. So like first thing in the morning or even it, I hate to say this, but it even starts the night prior, because I feel like if I could do a little bit at night where I know all my clients are away from maybe computers and not even in their office and all that other stuff or different time zones, maybe it allows me to sleep a little better knowing a bunch of stuff's been either thrown out or things have been updated in emails. And I know like, great. So in the morning, what I was doing was admin first, like a lot of the little, like the odds and end things, the things that like have to just be happened to or done to get out of my mind and be, okay, guess what? Now I can be a creative because that's done. Then it was like emails. And then it was like changes and revisions and things that are waiting for me to make. Cause I find those first few hours of the day maybe aren't the best time for me to be 100% like, you know, Mr. Creativity and design from scratch stuff. So I was doing that. Then creeping into like maybe before lunch and all after lunch was the true stuff, the things that I have to look at and really take the time to construct and make something new and creative, you know, and really, and then sometimes even after five, if there was, if, because we talked about flexibility, right? And if you did something later than earlier in the day and you knew you'd be working later at night, I love to do the more creative stuff then too, because it's uninterrupted. I'm not getting a phone call or email. So it's almost like in those crazy times is where you really have no other alternative, because otherwise you're just going to drop everything, right? And you're going to fail. So like sometimes I'm one of those people that has to be pushed, like, so no procrastination, whatever, because there's just no other alternative. But you give me 4 months to do something and I will do it the end of the last night. by nature. Right? So now it's like, yeah, now is a whole other different week. It's like 7 or 8 projects, but they're smaller scope. So now they're, oh, and each one of them's going like this all day long and intertwining. So you just gotta know how to go with the flow. But I think you do have to have core things, like you were saying too, where you find the best time of the day. There's a great book out there that was just talking about this, and I'll try to find the name of it, but it was trying to say there are time periods of the day where most of us can do things better because of the way we're wired. And it's good to know those things, because I just want pure efficiency when it comes to that.
Yeah. It's really figuring out, your personal, like, when you are creative. And it's not something that you can just turn it on and off. But I do find, like, you know, if I put myself in the habit, or like we kind of talked about in that episode of my office is where I do certain things. It's where I can design and work and plot out stuff. So, like, I don't hang out in here. Like, every time I'm in here, my brain is in that mode. Sort of like when I'm in my bed, I know that's where I sleep and I'm going to get tired, right? And so I think, just figuring out your own personal process and capitalizing on that. And I do think you hit it well with, like, it's nice not to have interruptions. So, like, I do, like, the evening creations or maybe even early morning before I start my email. Because throughout the day, like, you're going to get interrupted a lot. Like, I'm getting emails all day. I might get some phone calls, people reaching out. And so if I'm trying to get, like, really absorbed into that project, it's hard when there are that many distractions.
Very true.
What about you, Ryan?
Yeah, so that's one thing, like, I think I've really been trying to work on. Well, one of the things, but I mean, I agree. I think what I've, so Jordan, I think I listened to you talking to about earlier on how you would take, like, really, like, kind of like detailed, almost like logs, you know, of your projects and clients, and even like your hours. So,
When I first started, for sure.
Yeah. And like I mentioned, from my background, working at the agency, like, that was just not even there. So I think I unfortunately kind of got in this habit of just, like, not doing any of that stuff. So, I think what I'm really trying to do is start working on something like that, where I start logging more, you know, and kind of almost doing, like, postmortems after a project, you know, like, what happened, like, that was unexpected, you know, like, recently I was doing these labels. And they didn't decide on a label printer, like, before. And so I set it up according to my printer specs. Yeah. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh, we're going to be doing these shrink labels through a different company. They're different sizes and different specs. So I'm like, no. I already quoted them and everything, right? So then, you know, it wasn't the end of the world, but it did take me, you know, like an hour and a half additional to set that up. And that was basically kind of like time lost from my end. So I'm trying to, like, you know, if I did, like, a postmortem and I kept that in mind, the next client that comes around, I might be like, oh, you know what, I better add this padding in there, or like, or the next one be like, if you don't have a client, if you don't have a printer chosen and you don't have a template ahead of time, then that might be an additional cost after we, you know, sign off on the final design, you know, like, it's all a learning process. Right.
But,
And it's those few times where, like, oh, damn it, there's an hour and a half I just lost. But then the next time it's like, now I'm ready for that. It's part of the process.
Yeah, exactly.
I almost think, too, it would be smart that, I'm glad we're bringing this part up, because if someone told me this at the beginning, I'd feel a lot better when these big mistakes or these big things happen that I go, write that down, because the next time I write a quote, I got to remember that. You know. And so then your estimate becomes much more layered and much more intensive, because we could tell you 1,000 times, make the best invoice, but until you go through one of these things and feel the hurt of losing maybe a few hours and some money, you'll never do it.
Yeah.
That's true. Right. And then if you start using that and start building up You know, this again, like, will, like, I think help you look like an expert for the next one, because you know, like, oh, like, you know, oh, you don't have your UPC code set up for your labels. Okay, well, guess what? That's gonna take time, and you're gonna have to figure that out. Yeah. But I can help you or point you or whatever. But
$100 a pop.
Or like, you're at the point where, like, I have like a couple t-shirt printers and other guys where, like, I bring them work and they give me whatever, a 10% discount, but I can push that onto my clients. And I'm like, I worked with these guys, works great. They can give us 10% off and you don't even have to worry. Like, I'll reach out to them and I'll set it all up. I have my templates. They, you know, it's all ready to go. It streamlines my process and you're giving that benefit to the client. So that kind of stuff really helps too.
Yeah. So then I guess then, on the same topic, I'm curious to see, like, what, you know, as I mentioned, like, working 9 to 5 for an agency, you're not necessarily keeping track of billable hours, and that becomes a very real thing once you start doing your own, running your own business. So curious to think, like, from your guys' perspective, like, what do you think a realistic amount of, like, billable hours in your day is these days? I mean, obviously, that's factoring in, like, client communication, emails, meetings, marketing, billing, and all that, you know?
It averages at least 8 to 9, I would say, for sure. You get those amazing days where everything's said and done, and you just see a little, you see that little beacon of hope that, like, there's maybe a few hours available to do something fun, and that becomes a day where there's maybe only 2 hours that you did something. But, and then there's all-nighters all the time, you know? So I think it's about trying to level them out and trying to get there. It's impossible sometimes to do it, but what I try to do is say, okay, if 8 or 9 is my average, I want to make sure that that's a goal, and then that I can look at those hours and say they were accounted for in some way. Yeah. But then on the flip side, I'm trying to stay away from hourly and be more value-based in a way, even up front. So sometimes I feel like that it hurts the whole transition of going to value-based, because when you start, you're still thinking hours. It kind of,
I mean,
kind of cripples you a little bit.
I
never want to be asked that. Like, I don't want to be asked how many hours it did on that. When a client says or whatever, I'm just like, you don't understand. And there was something I saw this morning where it said, like, you know, I could do something in 10 minutes because I've worked 30 years to get there.
Right.
Like, that's the whole, so that's what you're paying for. But yeah, what do you think, man?
I mean, I'm the same way. I definitely avoid hours whenever possible. And the only time I might bring them in is, like, if, you know, for example, like, I do posters for a place in Portland and just illustration work. And then the next year they might want the same poster but have a couple of revisions. I'm like, okay, this is going to take me an hour or two.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, I'll do it that way. Or if it's, like, any sort of revision that wasn't in the contract, I'm like, okay, well, fine, we'll do an hour base there. But I typically at this point I try to avoid hourly altogether. And I think you hit it right where it's like, well, if I do it faster, why am I being punished? Yeah. Because my experience, you know, provides that. So, I'm on the same page.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm totally, absolutely trying to get into value-based pricing. I guess I was coming with the approach from that question is just from an internal business.
Oh, I gotcha.
Like, running a business, you know, like, because I think that was another thing that, like, you know, you might come out of, like, an agency, or you might start your business being like, oh, like, yeah, I'm going to get 8, like, billable hours of time a day. You try to figure out your hourly rates, you know, even though even if you're charging, like, clients by the project, and you're trying to get away from hourly, you still factor in your time based on how much you think it's going to take, you know, and then you might go, okay, well, like, yeah, add some padding to that, whatever, and then come up with your pricing. And or when you're starting your business, like, oh, if I want to make, you know, this much per year, divide that by billable hours. And if you say, like, okay, I'm going to have 8 billable hours per day, then I found that, like, you kind of sometimes have to be realistic. You know, you're not factoring client meetings, or you're not factoring, like, unless you're going to be working like 12 hours a day, which, you know, hopefully you don't have to do. But so I think that's what I think for somebody starting, I think that's really something that's kind of be eye opening. I think that's why I asked in that way.
It's almost it's like a parallel, you know, fact checker to your day and to your pricing, by keeping that in line with however you're pricing and making sure it's working. Can you break that down in an hourly for your own good? Totally right. I think that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, then you also have to see on task two, like you're talking about the freedom, you know, control of running your own business. It's like, well,
Setting goals.
Yeah, you're like, well, shoot, I built 10 hours yesterday, so yeah, I can go take the afternoon off tomorrow or what today or whatever and go grab a beer and you know, whatever. I mean, I guess, so I think jumping on, I wanted to talk to the idea of contracts, which again was from episode 6, I believe. And I know, Jordan, I know you mentioned like hiring a professional to help build your contract.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, essentially like what I did, I found a sort of a template and I brought him this and he's like, this is, you know, close, but here's some things you should put. And I told him like what I was planning on, what I wanted. Most of these little idioms I put in, like, I've changed since, but having someone where it's like, this is legitimate, just that peace of mind, especially when it comes to the contract. And that was, I don't have a personal lawyer. I know some people, a lot of designers do. But for me, it was just like, it was a one-time fee. And I think there's value in that investment of like, okay, I know my contract as it stands is sound. Like I have confidence in that when I send it out there versus, look, there's templates online, but you don't really know like where they're coming from, who wrote it. And so, yeah.
Just because it sounds legit doesn't mean it is.
Yeah, exactly. Fancy lawyer talk, but like it doesn't necessarily mean that it's like, going to hold up.
What is that word?
Yeah. Yeah. And this was, I mean, this was only just a couple hours, really.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess, yeah, so, right. And I, you know, I'm always like just put together my own contract. I've like found like pieces of contracts. I'm just like, oh, that's really great. I should add it. So I just like hobbled together my own, you know?
Sure.
So, but I was just kind of interested to get that perspective from you a little bit. And so, I mean, like when you found somebody, to hire on to help with the contract, I mean, was it somebody that was experienced in design and branding or like marketing or, you know, and were you able to find somebody that like was kind of on the more affordable side, but, you know, was obviously able to like get you something exactly what you needed?
I kind of lucked out because a client of mine has a really good design and trademark lawyer that they use. And I hired him for, I think it was like 2.5 hours or something for him. And then we just had a quick meeting. It was like a lunch and he cut me a little bit of a deal, but we essentially talked about it. Like I had a base and I told him, you know, this is what I want to do. And, you know, I asked him if like he's seen things that kind of, you know, that could be missing on this contract, et cetera. And so I got lucky in that regard, but I do know that there are like more affordable eyes on this sort of thing. And I bet there's actually probably at this point, like, you know, sort of companies that can do this even online where it's like a Skype call or something like that.
Yeah. You could do like LegalZoom. Which is
that's what it is, yeah.
Which is really great, and it's pay per use with a lawyer that kind of specializes in small business. They can even be in the freelance world and have some knowledge of what to look for and help you put it together. So I think at the least you're looking at something like maybe $150 for someone's time to do something unique if they want to review something you've done. You know what a lot of young designers I know have done is they know someone that they trust, maybe a friend of the family or whatever, and they offered some design services in conjunction to them looking over their contract just as a nice, you know, check off. So get creative with that. Don't ever forget the bartering thing because it's like, man, it's still to this day.
I do the same thing, man. I got a lot of my wedding stuff like when I bartered.
Oh, good.
No, that's right, man.
Yeah. Like I saved so much money on my wedding by trading some stuff. It was awesome.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I use LegalZoom. I use LegalZoom to set up my LLC.
Nice.
And so I mean I'll definitely probably take a look at that option. But that's a good point. Like I do also know some like attorneys just through my podcast and trademarking stuff, so I might look at
that. Oh, that's
cool.
There you go.
Yeah. So when you came to that, so you said you kinda already had a bit of a contract together. Or like, did you come to them with what you had and you're like, here's maybe like a bullet list of items that like they're maybe concerns you or like maybe bullet list of items that you're like, oh, I think I need this or like, What did you bring them to them? Or
I brought them. I did the same thing, I think, as a lot of young designers. So I found a template, and then I found bits and pieces that seemed to work within like what I was gonna do. With,
yeah, like, just like
logos
I'm doing.
And stuff. Yeah, and I essentially just brought that to him, and he kind of there was a few edits and a few shifts, and then there were pieces where you know he talked about like I've seen this happen. This could be a good clause or whatever it is. But yeah, I essentially just brought him what I found online. And it wasn't like it wasn't bad. And I don't want to say like every template's bad, but for me, it was a peace of mind that I knew what I had would hold up. Because when you freelance again, like you are vulnerable in that aspect, and hiring a lawyer for something like that, it can be really expensive. So having just something, just some sort of like concrete behind myself felt gave me more confidence.
Hmm. Yeah, totally. Cool.
Because yeah, I've sent a few out where I didn't have that, and you kind of do feel a little like, oh dang.
I know.
Let's just hope they didn't. There's something in there that you know, like, and I have had a few where they do read it like a fine tooth comb, and they're like, we have a few questions regarding boom boom boom, and so yeah, yep. You want to not only have it correct, but you want to be knowledgeable of it. You want to have someone explain it to me in maybe some more of my terminology.
That's a really good point, actually. We're not professionals. And that's something that can be really beneficial. You got to know what's in it.
Know it, yeah.
Because I've had that too, where people have asked, like, you have this section, what happens if blah, blah, blah? And it's like, oh, I don't even know what that means.
Yeah,
you
know what I know.
And so do you format your, because I know you've talked about making every touch point, like, just, like, as awesome as possible. And, like, and I've talked to Nick before about this, like, trying to make your contracts as friendly and as like user friendly as possible. Like, have you like designed your contract to make it like more of like a experience, or like, you know, like maybe introduce open each section with like a plain English, like, hey friend, like this is just let you know that if this happens, this is what's happened, but here is the legal terminology or whatever.
Here's Bob, my lawyer, to tell you more.
And that's a big one, and definitely something I do. And oftentimes if I'm sending a contract, it's because we already sort of defined the whole scope in the project. And so it's usually not just fine print. It's like the entire what to expect. Here's what we're going to achieve, how to achieve it, yada, yada, the time, the budget. Everything's in there in my own words. And it's also got like it's branded towards my own brand, and it looks the part. And then a few pages in there will be, and I call it just like the fine print. And that's where like really the contract sits. But the entire thing is the scope. And the contract is just a couple pages in maybe a 10 to 15 page document, maybe not that long, but, and then the last page they sign. So it isn't just, sending over a contract, because that can be pretty aggressive and intimidating for a lot of new, you know, clients starting off.
Oh,
I do want to set the tone of like,
walk them through
it in my voice. Yeah, exactly. Walk them through the whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jordan also does a books on tape. He does an audio version of his contract.
My contract?
It's on iTunes if you want to listen to it.
That's
guys.
So funny.
I want to see like those cheesy old commercials, like a Glamour commercial.
It's got
like
this really
soft
cool
stars.
Yeah.
Soft like jazz video in the background.
Yeah. Hey, I'm Jordan, and let me tell you about my contract.
After Hours with Jordan.
That's amazing.
Oh, we're gonna have to make a graphic for that. So
absolutely.
Well, cool, man. So we're at an hour mark, considering maybe edits and stuff. I do had a couple more questions. It wouldn't be too long, or I don't know where you want to.
Let's do quick fire or rapid fire.
Well, they're not quick fire, but yeah, they're just maybe.
I just love rapid fire questions.
Okay. All right. Okay, so yeah, I guess I'll jump around a little bit again here. I'm gonna head back to episode one with pros versus cons, and I think this specific one is on like getting paid. You know, and so you can't always get, you always can't like control getting paid in full on time, or maybe not at all. Hopefully that's never the case. But what ways have you found to like help out with this, like getting paid in any fashion, and try to like reduce the risk of like that happening, of you getting burned, or if someone like paying you like just way crazy late. You know, I know like for myself, I started collecting like down payments like as a must for first clients. You know, or I know you can like bill clients based on milestones. Just kind of curious to hear your perspective on, you know, setting yourself up to avoid losing money or being paid late in that kind of sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think this ties right back into the contract for me. I always break the payment up at least half upfront, half on deliverables. And if I have a little clause in that if the project terminates, then it's non-refundable that first half. Mm-hmm. And so that to me is like, you know, that is, I think, crucial. And if it's like a big payment and the client like has issues, like then I'll break it up maybe into quarters. And this will be like, especially, you know, all stages in the brand process too, where it's like, all right, stage one is going to be like defining your like pillars and whatever. And so then after that, I get paid. And then stage two is going to be design exploration. After that, I get paid. You know what I mean? So it's definitely, I definitely don't take final payment at the end. Circumstances, I mean, that might, if it's like not, you know, a big budget maybe, or if the client's like pretty small, or if it's a friend or favor. But nowadays, yeah, I definitely take down payment for sure. Because I definitely have been burned, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And it really takes like one or two times where like, I'm not going to do that anymore.
This is one of those like topics for me that unfortunately I feel like I've had to dumb down my communication to particularly new clients. And I do this so much now because it just seems to be, I know a lot of designers, regardless of size, scope, experience, are all dealing with this. And it's, you could try as much as you can, you do all these other things, but it's the late payment. It's the pay, not paying your net terms that is driving me absolutely crazy. And what I've learned is don't just put it in contract and get them to sign it and then start a project and just hope and pray they're going to pay on time. I talk them through that page specifically and say, look, like we're doing, even with a 50% deposit down, we're still doing a ton of work with the hopes that you're going to pay, you know,
on time.
And I'm still giving you 10 days. Like that's still, even though a lot of people go, oh, 10 days, that's, and I'm like, that's still a lot. If you have deliverables in your hand and you're thinking of using them and going out there and printing or whatever, guess what? I need to get paid. Well, so,
and that's why I don't send them also the copyright transfer until I get that final payment. So like they don't own it until I send them that. And yeah, so that definitely comes last. Like they'll once I get paid full, I'll send them that over.
So apparently you got to be a bit of the police here. You really do, man. You're like, there's laws and you have to stick by them and you got to tell them and explain it to them in communication, not just hope that they read that line and whatever. Because a lot of times it might, the person on the other end might be the person writing the check. It might be going to an accounts payable. It might be going to a holdings company of a bigger company. No two are alike when it comes to this for my client list, right?
Yeah.
They're all different. So I just want to make sure whoever my contact is, they are well aware of what, and they have to be a champion for that in their world because I've been on that other side of it. And when I had a freelancer that would call and say, you know, it was due today, I didn't get it, I'm marching down to accounts payable and finding out immediately. And I want them to do the same for me. Obviously, that comes with you providing great work and great service. They'll fight for you. But unfortunately, this is one of those things, man. I don't know. Someone's got to figure out a much – there's got to be a better solution in a way here. So again, when my invoice goes out in the biggest bold print, it says exactly what the date is that this is due by and that auto it automatically puts late fees in if it is 1 second late when it comes to the due date and that they know that from the very beginning as well. And my late charges, unfortunately, are – a lot because I don't want to get stuck with this anymore.
Yeah.
I got really burned with that. I hate it. I'm dealing with it today. Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Late payment is something that I have found it's a constant battle. I haven't really, I mean, like there are certain clients that are better with it, but man, it's an everyday thing for sure.
Yeah.
Well, and also I was going to say if it accounts payable people, their goal is to stretch out as far as possible
to pay vendors
and stuff. So don't even get yourself started in that situation. Tell them up front how important this is. And if that's part of the are we a good fit conversation, you know what I mean? So
I even found that even with larger clients, especially when you have an accounts payable section, like it does end up being later than a lot of like these like smaller to medium. Like, it's crazy. Yeah. I thought it would be better, and that's one thing that it kind of flipped on me. Like, it takes me longer to get paid.
The last one I agreed to, and this hurts, but it's a big client, 60-day terms.
Yeah.
It's been 74 days and still no payment. And I'm sitting here going, and then you can't be an ass to your guy, your contact, because it's not really him. And it's a whole other office in a whole other state that is dealing with accounts payable. So goes with the territory, man. What are you going to do?
Right.
Yeah.
Welcome to freelance.
So I'm curious. I obviously different. Each business might be different, especially like you're talking about, Nick. Like, if it's a large enough organization or a large enough corporation or business, it's, they might. Yeah, you may not be able to get away with it. But I'm curious if either of you tried doing. You get no deliverables or assets until paid in full. Have you tried any of that before?
Yeah, I've done that before.
Yeah, I think we both talked about that before. I know. I think I know exactly. With new ones, I'm going to be a sticker on that 100%. And they until payment. They don't get the final. It's like, again, I hate being that way, but with someone new, like, I'm gonna do that.
Everything works that way. You know what I mean? Like,
oh my God.
You buy it and then you get it. Like, it's not, that is the standard for sure. And if I don't, like, say, like, there is a client where, especially if it's gonna be like a long term client, there's gonna be a lot of work after that. And they wanna get going with stuff, and I'm not just sending like, everything's done at this point. Like, if you need this logo because you want to start putting it on social media, like, okay, fine. But you're not going to get the again, that copy transfer until that payment. So, like, you can do what you want, but you don't own this yet. And I definitely make that clear.
Transfer of ownership is crucial.
So, I mean, I've kind of had this experience where, and I mean, projects are going to be flexible, but you know, I've had clients come to me and they're like, oh yeah, I mean, I'm going to be talking about beer because it's what I do mostly, but they're like, we need labels. We need tap handles. We need sales sheets. We need, you know, like, I don't know. They've got a list of like 8 things, whatever.
Yeah, coasters, keg colors, all that stuff.
Yeah, you got it. Right. So then I'm like stoked. And so I put together this proposal and it's like, here's a proposal for all that stuff, you know? And they're like, and they want to do it. And then they're like, whatever. So you might get to the point where they're like, okay, to start off with a relationship, or like, you know, we can take this down a bit and maybe let's just do the labels and the tap handle just to start with, just so that way, like, you don't have to give me a 50% down payment for like these 8 items or whatever. And once we get to these phases, we'll start working on these other items, you know, which is a way to kind of, it helps both parties. I think it can, like, in that they're not having to give you as much down payment, but you're getting paid for your time, and help mitigating like that possibility of getting paid late or not getting paid starts the relationship.
But the number can be pretty daunting, right? If you're going to hit all 9 of those plus a logo, like, that could be a big number. Might intimidating off and just kind of look elsewhere. Right. So that's smart.
But on your end too, then it becomes you're juggling 8 invoices rather than 1. So keep in mind, your paperwork and your admin's going to skyrocket there.
Well, and so, and then you can break it down into phases. You can be like, well, you know what? You don't really need the coaster yet because you're going to need the label first, you know, and then you're going to need a tap handle first because you're going to start doing distribution now to, like, you know, tap houses. But then, so the one thing I've found, which has been, you know, kind of a bummer about taking that approach, is that things shift a lot. And I've done that with a proposal. I've had all these items and I'm like so pumped. And then by the time I get like the 3rd item done, they're like, you know, we really don't need that anymore. So it's kind of a two-edged sword. It's like, well, you get less of a down payment because you're maybe only going to do like 2 projects to start. But then I'm always just like, man, should I just done all of it like the beginning? Because then like you're kind of locking in that business as opposed to like them like changing their mind because they've had enough time to sit on it and be like, you know what, actually maybe we don't really need that or whatever. So
I would say that's an opportunity. Look, in that circumstance, if I want to work with them, you know, if I want to retain and continue on, because I can't imagine like a brewery's not going to need stuff down the road, but maybe
right
then they will. So that's kind of stuff where I might talk them out of all the stuff up front and focus on, I mean, it depends on their budget, right? If they're worrying about money, like, I want them to trust me. And so I definitely want to give them the best advice I can. It's like, if you're worrying about money, like, you don't need these things as you open.
Yeah.
But we will need them down the ride. And here's
prioritize a lot more.
Yeah.
But if they grow soft on them, like, I guess that's a missed opportunity, but I think if you do it in a way where like they trust you,
yeah,
then they're going to need them at some point.
Totally.
And having them on board, you know, if you, you know, retain them, there's so much more value than just, I think, you know, getting it and maybe they realize like, man, we spent way too much money and this isn't moving. Like, and you might lose that trust. Then that could like really sink that ship.
Yeah. Well, no, that's a good point too, because it's going back to like building yourself as like the expert in the very beginning. You know, it's
totally.
Like, you're like, guess what, man? Like, yeah, you're starting up or whatever stage you're in. You really don't need to do this all at once. Like, yeah, let's break this down and like you're gonna need this first. And you know, guess what? In 3 months, I know you're gonna need this, and so we'll tackle that once that comes up. So
that's the best way to do it, right? Because you're helping them define that go-to-market strategy anyway, and especially like. If they're comfortable showing numbers, which I would hope that would be the case, at least to an extent, like you can really like, okay, here's the best way to put this that's going to help you, you know, achieve this strategy that we're laying out now. And then we'll set a timeline for this stuff later on once you land this, this, and this. Like helping them define, because like a lot of these, especially breweries, like they're either home brewers or people that just got out of school. Like they don't really know. None of them are necessarily business owners, right? And or they are, but they're not. And so like it is your job to take that experience and really help shape that process and how to go to market and strategy and what they're going to need. And so this is a great opportunity to really let them know and kind of take that baton and take charge in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
All right. So down to my last question. And this is going, I believe, back to episode 5 with clients. And so you were talking about the idea of, like following and interacting with businesses you want to work with on social media.
Sure.
I mean, I think that's a great idea. But I was kind of curious because the agency I worked at did a lot of social media management for companies.
Cool.
And I know, I mean, I've interviewed people on my podcast that work at breweries that there are social media managers or marketing managers, and they're the ones doing it. So I'm kind of curious if you have much of experience, but like, cause you say you're interacting with this social media account that you hope to work with. Like you have no idea who's the person behind that firewall. Like they could be just some like farmed out social media, like agency.
Yeah.
And so you're just kind of talking, honestly, like to deaf ears, but you're not talking to the right decision maker at that company.
That's true.
Yeah. So, I mean, like getting on the radar of that decision maker, it's like super important. So I'm curious, like if you have any thoughts or experiences like with that, like interacting with these brands and or these businesses and what kind of outcomes and just your thoughts on that in general, you know, like, cause you could be just talking to the marketing manager, may not be the decision maker as far as when it comes to like, oh, we need a rebrand or whatever.
Yeah.
Or like you said, an outsourced social person that's not even working for
exactly.
the company.
Exactly. That's the worst. Yeah. That's the worst case scenario. Yeah.
Yeah. You're talking at an empty room sort of at that point. And this comes from, I have done a lot of this when I first started, and I don't necessarily do it now, but it wasn't just like I would find a cool brand around locally and follow them. It was, you do a little research. And also, you know, even the people that run that social media, I think at least for small businesses, and again, we're kind of talking about small businesses, so most of them they don't have the budget to hire.
Exactly.
Out. Like when I'm starting off, I'm not going after some major companies, but usually it's someone internal, or if they do have a budget to hire someone on the marketing or just to do the social media, they could be a really great reference, right? Because if like, and I'm looking at breweries because a lot of that started with that, or even like local coffee shops around Portland here. Like I found that anyone who was doing the social media was kind of had a voice in the brand and the logos and the things that they needed a designer for. And so that was kind of, I did find those kind of people really actually helped, versus just someone, you know, just an owner who had an iPhone that didn't really pay attention. Social media people usually have a good grasp on good design, what works in terms of marketability, all that stuff. So I think that can actually work in favors, depending though. And this is just one facet to really, sort of work
this
in
topic.
You're talking about. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, you're right. 'Cause they're plugged in somehow and they're going to be. They're better than no connection at all to that company, which is one thing. And then in a lot of cases too, I think most places are being done there. It is sometimes the owner. It is sometimes that struggling business person that's going, I don't have the money to pay that. But now, will that be a good client in the long run? Maybe not. But I think a good way to maybe draw kind of a line down the middle of this topic is that's all Instagram and maybe even Twitter, but the LinkedIn side becomes a bigger discussion because one, you're following companies, people running the companies of maybe who you could be a potential client there are truly incorporated into the company and part of the company, maybe in their marketing team. So again, that it's a, maybe a different conversation there because of the connection might be a little bit more real and it's so much more business and networking based, right? So where I found good success was that when people that were either following me or found me through friends of friends or colleagues of colleagues made the connection because what I was posting on there was always great case studies. It wasn't just a pretty picture on Instagram. It allowed you to post a PDF or post a multi-page slide thing or something that allowed you to be a little more descriptive with what you did and throw in the benefits and what you did for that client. And now that person saw it over and over again as I was posting and they made the connection finally when they needed someone, they thought of me. So
yeah,
it kind of is a different animal on those different things. So I think it's, you got nothing to lose with them, right? They're all free. It's time and dedication of what you put in there. But I wouldn't want to say on the Instagram and Twitter side that you might be talking to deaf ears because I think those people can do something for you. And I've seen that happen sometimes, you know?
Yeah. But it is good to do a little homework or your best judgment. Like, you know, especially if like the photos and content they're putting in is of the people in the brewery, behind in the kitchen, like odds are it'll be someone there.
Yeah.
If it's more generic, you know, like stock imagery, like, well, then, it's probably hired out for sure.
Yeah, yeah. There's some certain accounts I can totally tell they just hired an agency because it's so canned. It's just not very personal.
Yeah. But and there's also just, like, even more tricks. Like, if we're talking about that specific subject, like, maybe it's – and a good tool that I use is, like, maybe I'll go into that facility and I'll, like, take a picture of myself. And I did this, designing something cool on my computer in that coffee shop, and I tag them. And like, whoa, that looks great, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? Like, those kind of little things.
Oh, this little thing I just did.
This whole thing?
Yeah.
But I have had a couple successions with that sort of approach where it's like I just tag them in it. Or even just recently with my photography, I tag the people who make the lights and I got a job offer. Like, or just a project offer, right? So like, social media, again, the whole part of that was like, it just felt like it was like this, you know, circle jerk of designers showing and telling their own design work to other designers.
Yeah.
And there is value in that in terms of networking, but like, or the community. But I just wanted to take a step out and like, you know, you can use social media to actually like get jobs because more often than not, these designers aren't going to hire you.
Exactly.
Especially when you're all starting off.
Yeah.
Yeah. I totally. My approach is, to talk to your point, Jordan, I think it was, I'm getting ready to start hitting some pavement and like, I'm going to go set up shop like in some places with my computer and just to like, cause I think you can start conversations. I think, especially if you get into a business like earlier in their workday when they're not like the right people are there, you know?
Yeah.
And then you could be like, they're like, oh, what are you doing? Or, like, what are you working on? Or, like, cause
I've seen
like illustrators and artists and stuff like that are working inside of like a brewery or coffee shop and like the people are like, oh man, that's dope. What are you doing? Or whatever, you know?
Totally.
But again, I think to the point of this talking about social media is that I try to like, without getting too creepy or whatever, like, you know, try to go around and find like, who's the marketing manager for that company or who try to find the owner and see if they have
account. Oh yeah, man.
Follow that because most of those people are posting about their jobs a lot anyway. Cause if they're in a certain industry, like specifically brewing and especially like they're in that industry and they work for that company. So they're always posting stuff about that. So if you can start interacting with those folks and you're getting on their radar, you know, what I think I'm always looking when I follow somebody and they work at a brewery, like a lot of times they'll like post some cool, like behind the scenes pics. And like, I always like tap on that photo to see if they tagged everybody. So like, you can be like, who do they work? Oh, they work for, oh damn, that's the marketing manager. What's up? Like, follow you, whatever.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Private.
I think that's where, like, you know, we're going to do an episode about LinkedIn. And I know we also talk about a lot, but that is seems to be the best circumstance of like, well, you know, all those people, like they're all like, oh, that is the marketing manager for this company that I was curious about because it says.
It's based on title. You know? It's based on title, right? Like, that's the whole.
Because I do the same thing, Ryan, where it's like, if there's something cool, like, or if it's a great brand important, like, who is doing your work? What agency is doing it? I got to know.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Cool.
Nice.
Awesome, man.
Well, yeah, man. This has been fun. I think that was all I had, man.
I don't know about you guys, but I need a beer after that. Yeah. That was great. Yeah, that was really good.
Yeah, man.
Fantastic questions, thanks, man.
Yeah, thank you, man. I dig what you're doing, and thanks for having me on, because I think, like, you know, I think we're comrades and, like, friends in design and stuff like that, but there's so much stuff that, like, I mean, even your first course that I was listening to, and it's always just like, oh man, I gotta ask them this question or whatever, you know, like, or just, you know. And so this is cool to do, get on this one. And I think, again, like, I think I was a unique case, and I think a good example for someone to do the Q&A. So totally.
Thanks.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It.
Yeah, it's our pleasure to have
everyone
you on,
should check out Ryan and his podcast, and also your awesome website and services if you're looking for some beer stuff, craftbrewcreative.com.
Thank you.
And yeah, man.
Nice.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. So check out Branding Brews is a podcast I do if you're interested in beer design, beer branding. Brandingbrews.com or any of your, you know, your typical podcast spots. So yeah, it's been a blast. I think thanks again, guys.
Oh man, this has been great. All right. Well, there's another course in the books.
Yeah, all right. All right.
Well, guys, this has been fantastic. We will talk to y'all soon. And thanks for listening.
Bye.
Yes, that does it for the entire creative course. Number 2, everything about freelance. But we have a bonus episode for you right after this. So be sure to listen right after this. Episode 7 is a great interview with our friend John Contino. It's kind of a bonus episode. We talk a lot about his travels through freelance and agency work in the beginning of his career. So don't miss it. It's up next, episode 7. Thanks so much, guys. Talk to you soon.